Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab tested, real results. Go to mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games. This is your podcast about board games. We're going to be talking about games this week, and I'm going to be talking about games with the person I know best to talk about games with. Yes, that is a proper sentence in English. Michael Walker, how you doing, Walker?
That's me.
Yeah, it's you.
I am.
That's why I said it, because it's you.
The,
I said the name. That's
I am
why
the
I said
best
you.
To talk with, because you're practiced at talking over me in particular, so it's probably the best.
Really? Person. This is how we're going to be leading in?
Yeah.
Are we starting already?
It's pretty weak. I understand. That's all I got. That's why you complete me, Mark.
I should have been talking over you is what I'm learning. So we're going to be talking about what we reviewed last year in our as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment, The Eurus. We're going to be talking about the games we played last week. We're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. And then our topic for the week, which is something that is very, very fraught in the hobby, and that is, take that! So, the as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment, The Eurus, what we reviewed last year.
It was interesting. When you said Eurus, yeah. I felt very much like a corporate president at a Coldplay concert.
Taken by surprise?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So what did we review? We keeps it current here at So Wrong Games. What did we Mark? I know what we reviewed exactly a year
your
ago.
Your extensive but preparation.
But your
listeners, you don't understand.
You're so prepared.
The moment
hit
stop, the moment I start editing the podcast, Walker's already researching for next week's episode.
Exactly. And
that's how dedicated he is. He spends the entire week. So, by Matt Leacock and Matteo Menapace, we reviewed Daybreak. This is the CMYK crowdfunding co-op game about climate change and climate adaptation, exhaustively researched, full of citations about a very pressing issue by one of the designers of Pandemic. We played it a bunch of times.
Yeah, I was going to say, we played it once or twice since, and you're going to play it more. It is on Board Game Arena as well, so it's a great way to try it out if you haven't played it already, because you can cycle through solo games very quickly on Board Game Arena.
Yeah, and especially since the actions that you take it's pretty free form. It's, you know, this is the action phase. Everyone gets to do whatever they want with their cards and so forth. And there are cooperative actions, of course. You can activate abilities to help out your colleagues. But at the end of the day, much of the time, you're just managing your own energy and decarbonization needs. And I've said it before a number of times. I really appreciate it when, I appreciate it when a game is transparent about its political framing. I don't know that Daybreak is especially transparent about its political framing, but I will say that its political framing is one that accords to my political priors, right? So it's speaking to my, like, as somebody who obviously regards the threat of climate change as being very serious, Daybreak is A, pro-nuclear, and B, pro-adaptation. I'm not saying that these are at the exclusion of anything else. I'm not poo-pooing wind power, I'm not poo-pooing solar power, I'm not poo-pooing climbing down on energy needs and so forth. But as somebody who finds it unfortunate that nuclear and adaptation often are undersold in the context of climate change technologies and tactics, I very much appreciate that Daybreak integrated those a lot. And it's one of those things where there's a newness bias, especially with technology. It's like, oh, the new shiny thing. It's like, okay, well, so there are some older technologies, and there's some things that are not even really technological at all, just about fundamental boring stuff like painting your roofs and crap like that, which in accretion can really matter.
Yeah, they just need to be implied, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Or applied. And I like how it's packaged as well. There's no plastic. It's all environmentally friendly stuff in the box. Nice touch.
Yeah, we enjoyed Daybreak. Very, very light, very approachable, very freeform in the sense of tableau building. So, a lot going for it. That is Daybreak by Matt Leacock and Matteo Menapace, published by CMYK 2023. So,
and that's the game we reviewed exactly 1 year ago.
It is. And now we're going to move on to the games we played last week. Walker, what did you play last week?
So, Mark, a new Star Wars Unlimited set just came out, and so I decided to pick it up because we haven't tried it yet. So this is a CCG, as they say in the biz.
Is it a CCG or an LCG? Or an ECG? Ooh, so many letters.
Oh, no, it would be a CCG, because you can buy blisters, so boosters, blisters.
Blind packaging?
Yes.
Blind buys? Oh, okay, so yeah, it's a CCG.
So this particular set is Darth Maul and Qui-Gon Jinn.
Oh my goodness.
And so it's because what's interesting, Unlimited, Star Wars Unlimited does nothing new. But what it does do is bring in all of the new stuff all into one game. So you've got instead of putting out land, you just put cards face down.
Yep.
As mana, it has two different theaters, has space and land that you're attacking in. It also has a commander in the middle, so you develop your commander to a point that he comes out to the field. Everything else is pretty well standard. You actually wound the creatures here. We were trying to think back. I could have sworn that you had to kill monsters outright in magic. And I'm pretty sure you do. Yeah.
Yeah, they heal at the end of every turn.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I was being not contradicted, but my partner didn't remember either. I'm pretty sure that's how magic worked, 20 years ago when I played it last.
Yeah.
And it's fine. I'm not a fan of this, here's a game with no rule book kind of thing, because they came separate boxes.
Okay. But were they actual boxes or were they large card boxes?
It was just a single box, not bigger than the deck itself. There was also a free booster inside, which we hadn't opened yet, but it was just the cards.
I see.
No leaflet, no nothing. So on the computer, look up, the actual rule book.
Look, if the price is reasonable, I was willing to give the new starter set for Netrunner a pass because of how compact and economic the starter set was. It was very inexpensive, given a contemporary hobby market, especially given that it was basically a fan creation that kind of made good. And it was just a slip box with the cards inside. In that context, I'm willing to give them a pass for the rules only being online. I'd have to see more about the packaging to judge in the case of Star Wars Unlimited, though.
You can get... There are starter boxes you can get, but they're always sold out. And it was only like the earlier sets. It came with the two decks in one box with a playmat and... I shouldn't say it came with rules, because now that I think of it, I'm not sure. But it did come with playmats and other things, so I'm going to assume that there was a rule book.
Do you know what actually offends me the most of this model? The ones where they give you a printed and bound version of the quick play rules, but for the full rules, you have to go online.
Yeah.
That is the biggest insult, because we know that you could have put a book in there, and you could have just put in more pages, but you decided not to.
So Star Wars Unlimited is designed by Jim Cartwright, Tyler Perrott, Daniel Schaefer, and Jeremy Zwin, and put out by Fantasy Flight Games. And there's already like another set announced, more cards coming out.
My understanding is that it is unlimited.
Completely unlimited.
Yeah.
The other thing about the boxes that they came in is that the only way to get the cards out, you'd have to destroy the boxes.
Really?
Yes. And it's an anti-theft thing, right? They don't want empty boxes sitting on the shelf.
Right.
Right. So, because not only are they missing cards now they've sold an empty box to someone, right?
Right.
So, yeah, so you have to rip it right open to get the cards out. So now where are you going to keep it? So now I've had to order a deck box for my Star Wars Unlimited. So thankfully, thankfully those are dirt cheap now. Anyway, Star Wars Unlimited, I'm eager to show it to you. It's got some interesting stuff going on. I'm glad I got it.
Okay.
It's Star Wars.
It's Star Wars?
Yeah.
I remember Star Wars.
Remember?
Yeah, I remember. I don't know, man. Yeah, on the one hand, like a well-done, competent, take seriously the gameplay innovations over the course of the past 30 years of CCGs is usually good for a laugh. It's just, it really depends on, it's so seldom that I play something, I'm like, ooh, I really want to go deep into this. I want to figure out the meta. I want to build a deck. I want to consider what.
Yeah, from my one play, that was not there.
Oh, okay.
It was more of, here's more of the same, but just, it's just everything done well. Like, there's none of these, like, weird corner cases that you fall into magic. Oh, where is that in the stack, Mark? Did we start the stack yet? None of that stuff. But so, yeah.
To be entirely frank, what I'd be more interested in doing is trying being the runner in Netrunner, because so far I've only been the corp.
Oh, is it every time you've talked, everyone wants to be the runner?
Yeah, pretty much.
Nice. Well, now
I've never been the corp. Well, it's just never been the runner, ever.
Now we both have sets. Maybe this will come to pass. We'll
sure,
see.
Sure. That is Star Wars Unlimited. I get to play Steam Power. Steam Power is, I'm going to use the words train game just descriptively. I realize that train gamers start to go into conniptions once you start talking about what is and is not a train game. It's a game about trains. How's that? Not necessarily a train game, but a game about trains. It is so strange.
Do trains play it?
I assume
not. Is it therefore a train game?
Walker, you're complicating the matter. There's a whole bunch of 18XX players that have already begun angrily writing replies, and now you're on their radar too. It's already too late for me, but you can escape, Walker. It is bizarre to describe the arc of Martin Wallace's career. So Martin Wallace is a longtime hobbyist designer. He came from the sort of historical wargaming background. He also came from a bit of the train gamer background, and he bursts onto the scene with Age of Steam and a whole bunch of other really sort of dense kinds of things. Now, the whole situation regarding Age of Steam is a massive legal cluster. I'm not going to touch that with a 10-foot pole. But a lot of Martin Wallace's output about 20 years ago were things that he were putting out through either War Frog or Tree Frog later, and these were pretty Baroque, edge case-filled, kind of obscure historical stuff. I'm talking about stuff like Liberté, I'm talking about stuff like Byzantium, even the non-historical stuff like A Study in Emerald. And he was just known for doing those kinds of things for a long time. He had his devoted audience, not entirely unlike the Cole Worley of his day, just in the sense of being somewhat niche, somewhat interesting topic choice, and often somewhat difficult to wrap your head around, especially if you were accustomed to lighter Euro fare. They both had different oeuvres, but in that sense, I think there's a strong comparison that can be made to the output of Martin Wallace and the contemporary output of Cole Worley. Now, with Wallace Designs, a new company, this is by my count the third publishing arm that is essentially the Martin Wallace publishing house. Now he's publishing games that are entirely removed from his original oeuvre from 20 to 30 years ago. And he's making very, very high quality components in the contemporary sense, not in the old wooden sense. Bakelite all over the place. Linen maps, which I guess aren't necessarily high quality. Highest quality would be neoprene, but he likes the little linen maps. And we've seen Bloodstones and now Steam Power. Steam Power is an incredibly simple train game. It is so far removed from the Age of Steam. It's not Railroad Tycoon. It's not Age of Steam. It's not even Cube Rails, frankly. It is a very, very, very simple sort of connection game.
Is it a cozy train game?
No, it's not cozy. It's definitely more in-depth and more train-y than something like Ticket to Ride. That is absolutely the case. But if I were to put things on a spectrum, it's roughly the same rules density, roughly, as some of your better Cube Rails games, but much less economical. There's not really an economic system in Steam Power. It is mostly about making the connections, whereas in a Cube Rails game, it's more about economic manipulation with the map dynamics serving the economic model. In the case of Steam Power, it is very much the other way around. It is the economic model in service of what is going on the map in terms of connecting the red city with the white city so you can fulfill the red good to white city requirement, and that gives you some Benny. It was all right. Honestly, I found that the luck of the draw was vastly too consequential because it's mostly about completing these contracts that you're dealt out at the start of the game. And one of the actions you can do is to get more contracts. But one of the benefits that contracts sometimes give you is getting more contracts or putting up more rails or putting out a factory, which are the other major things that you're going to be doing with your turn. So if you have the right things at the right time, things really work in your favor and you can get all these efficiencies. But honestly, I never really felt as though I was the master of my own destiny. I just had these contracts out and it seemed relatively obvious what to go for next. And the winner of the game was the one who effectively just connected to more victory point cities and other people didn't, because there are some cities that don't deliver goods. They just give you 4 or 5 victory points and it's divided amongst all the people that got there. Well, the map got pretty crowded with one exception. There was just one arm that happened to be where one player went off by themselves. Good for them. They made the right call and that proved to be determinative. And so it felt like a pretty unsatisfying dynamic when that many points can be driven either by the sheer luck of the draw from the contracts, when they come out, how they come out, what cities are available when they come out, etc., as well as, well, are other people going to make the effort to come develop and connect to these point cities that I've already connected to? That's not great. So it was okay, but I will acknowledge that there's a reasonable amount of game for a pretty simple rule set, but when compared to an obvious comparison set, namely Cube Rails games, there's not even close. So comparing Steam Power to something like Wabash Cannonball or Irish Gauge, there's just no comparison. I would play Irish Gauge or Wabash Cannonball any day of the week over Steam Power, and I didn't really think that it introduced anything really clever or new. The components, though, were really pleasant, like these Bakelite train tracks, as well as plastic locomotives. We played with the deluxe version. The plastic was really cool. Everybody had their own kind of weirdly retrofuturistic looking train pieces, even though the map we were playing on was late 19th or early 20th century. I couldn't tell you exactly. Anyhow, I gotta say, the whole train, its take on train gaming was, as I say, very much more in the Ticket to Ride kind of style, albeit more in depth. That's just not what I'm looking for anymore, frankly. I didn't find the economic modeling of Age of Steam particularly enjoyable to interact with, but it was fascinating. And I don't find Steam Power very interesting. So, all told, it was all right. As an intro weight game, it was okay. If you just want to connect cities and do train stuff, that's all right. It's a next step up from Ticket to Ride, I guess. So that was Steam Power, Martin Wallace, Wallace Designs 2024.
They had nice Bakelite tiles sliding along.
Yeah, it's true. Very nice. And look, there's definitely an appeal to that. And I absolutely liked all the chunky plastic and the chunky Bakelite. That was great. And honestly, if they made a super chunky, super satisfying version of some of the best Cube Rails games, I would happily make the upgrade, frankly. Although I do kind of appreciate the sort of ugly minimalism in a lot of Cube Rails games, to be honest, but... So that's Steam Power.
I decided to pick up a version of Spot It, right? So I was shopping on the online, and I saw a Bluey edition. And I had a feeling, I played Spot It many years ago, and my granddaughter loves Bluey. So
yeah,
there was
I've heard good things about this Bluey.
Yeah.
I've heard parents talk about how Bluey is surprisingly good.
Yes, it doesn't melt your brain like other children's shows do.
Sure, and it's not like that incredible Antichrist Caillou.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And when you play Spot It, you always got to remember to step a little bit to the left, because then the math vortex won't suck you in. Because
I beg your pardon?
Because Spot It does this weird thing, and it's this giant deck of round cards, and somehow they've mathed it out that when you flip two of them over, of the 25 shapes that are on the cards, only one of them match. So no matter what two cards, it's going to have one image on it that matches.
Huh.
And, you know, I'm sure we're going to get a message. Well, Mike, it's an easy math met. You take the... Okay, good job, geek. I have Mr. Swirly to introduce to you two, okay?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, all right. Wow. Walker, this hypothetical exchange has brought you full jock.
That's right.
It's like a 40-year time vortex, and you've completely reverted to your football playing instincts. This is wild.
Anyway, Spot It. So it's very much like Ghost Splits, where you're, you know, you flip a card, and you got to... You know, see what's the same between the two cards. And whoever points to it first is right. You score, you flip it. There's all sorts of other mini games I haven't looked at yet in the box. I was surprised to see that there was like a whole list of variants that you could play for Spot It. I'm interested to see what they're about. So Spot It, Bluey.
And you played it with your granddaughter?
I have not yet.
Oh, okay.
I just sort of got it out because it hadn't been so long since I played Spot It. It's like, you know, how does this work exactly? How have they made it so no matter what two cards come up, there's only going to be one image that is the same on the card. Like, I'm sure there's a simple mathematical equation that will explain it, but there it is.
Do you think your granddaughter would be able to play Spot It?
I think so.
Okay.
I think even at
not
this,
competitively, but
and I even think at this age of two, I think I'm going to try. I think
just as
they
a note,
understand.
Just as to emphasize to our listeners, we are never going to have this podcast devolve into the kind of smug posting you occasionally see on BoardGameGeek about how I just played Kalis with my 3-year-old daughter and it was great and I don't understand why the children...
Yeah, why does it say 5 to 8? My 2-year-old aced this game.
Yeah, exactly. She was able to put down her copy of War and Peace long enough to play 18XX with me. It was great. I don't understand why.
We had to stop early because we had to fulfill her college applications out, you
absolutely,
see.
Absolutely.
All right. That is Spot It. It is put out by Blue Orange Games and designed by everyone.
Played another game of Mosaic, A Story of Civilization. This is by Glenn Drever. This is a review copy we got from the publisher. And I maintain a solid love for Mosaic, A Story of Civilization. I'm beginning to come around, Walker, to your perspective that on occasion it could run too long. The length is a little bit variable based on where cards are shuffled into various supplies. And this is fundamentally a sort of card-driven civilizational thing. Yes, there's a map, and it occupies much of the physical space of the game. But in Mosaic, mostly it's about the cards. This is a tableau builder. And I'm just on the lookout for tableau builders that don't annoy me the way a lot of the tableau builders of 10 years ago felt very cookie cutter and derivative. And I suspect that is one of the main reasons why I enjoy Mosaic in the way that I do. There's precious little downtime. Turns are lightning quick. It's the kind of thing where everyone is constantly engaged because you're looking at the different card displays. They rotate through at roughly the right level. You don't see a whole lot of stagnation the way you do in a lot of other card games. And you're just constantly engaged. This particular session of Mosaic went a little over long. It ended up taking around 90 to 95 minutes, which is probably about 15 to 20 minutes longer than a game of Mosaic wants to go. But as I say, the downtime was light and everyone felt engaged, which is very cool. Now, none of the cards you acquire tend to provide huge effects on the game. It's a lot about symbol matching and a lot about getting to various thresholds of symbols, because a lot of the points are going to be disgorged based on whoever is the first to get to 6 symbols of this, or whoever's the first to found 3 port cities, or whoever's the first to get to 15 ideas production or what have you. But for a relatively straightforward, stripped-down, rough evocation of some of the Civ tropes, I find the theming relatively unobjectionable and the gameplay very engaging. And Glenn Drever is one of those designers who every once in a while, I think he designed something precisely calibrated to my tastes. He's also done some stuff that's rather less successful, but of his recent stuff, I think that Mosaic and Raccoon Tycoon are actually quite decent for what they're trying to evoke. Now, do you need the deluxe version with the mountains of plastic and the incredibly huge blocks? Probably not. Does it have a start player marker that is absolutely part of the recent trend of the start player markers? Start player marker arms race, such that it's about 8 inches tall. Yeah, you don't need that either. But I do appreciate a good game of Mosaic, and I was happy to get it back to the table. That is Mosaic, A Story of Civilization by Glenn Drever and Forbidden Games.
Played a bunch of games of Tower Bricks. This is designed by Simon Thomas and put out by Cosmos. It was out in Europe last year and now is available in North America. This is just a weird sort of mix of Decorum and The Gang. You are dealt out cards, and it'll say on your card, like, no yellow brick can be beside a red brick, or your purple bricks cannot be beside a horizontal brick. So you're dealt this card that has a rule on it. There's a bunch of bricks in the middle of the table, and everyone can just sort of start building at the same time. And when you're satisfied, you sort of put your thumb up, and then people might move bricks around, and then you'll have to move them back again. And you just keep going until you hopefully finally get to where everyone's card is satisfied. And I suppose you'll get to a point where you just give up.
because what is the lost condition?
Because, there's no time limit or anything. So I guess you just, either you make a mistake and you think you're you're good and you reveal and it's like, no, you got it wrong. There's like, this brick is actually touching here and you got it wrong. Or you just give up. It's like, I can't figure out what everyone's card is. So we'll just stop. Anyway, I sort of found that at 2 players, it doesn't shine as well as it does with more players because you have sort of less rules. I think they don't want you to be overwhelmed with a whole hand of cards that you're trying to keep you know, track of.
Sure.
Right? So you're, even with two players, not going to deal out a bunch of cards. So it's always, you know, everyone gets one card and then it slowly increases. You need to win three rounds. And I really enjoy it, especially at four. We streamed it. If you watch our live stream, you'll see it at the end. It's the second game we played. It's a great little game. I'm glad I picked it up. What did you think of it, Mark?
I confess, with two players, I was a little disappointed. There wasn't really an impetus for me to try to make inferences as to what it is you needed. I think only during that third round was I ever in a position to even speculate, because I just built something somewhat arbitrarily with my conditions. You then added a couple blocks that didn't get in the way of my conditions at all, and that was it. And you're done. Now, there is the possibility, A, of it being more interesting, as you say, with more players, and so I would happily try it with more. And B, there is a slightly more elaborated scoring system whereby you are incentivized to build more rickety structures that are both taller and less stable. We were mostly just clustering things around the table, as it were. But you get more points if you build something that's super tall and only has about two blocks at the base. And so that might encourage us to engage in slightly more risky behaviors and or more elaborate constructions. So as it is, base game only with two players, I didn't really think that there was much to be done. But with more players, with more, again, sort of a push to try to make a guess as to what other people are messing with. It's like, oh, they're always moving a purple block. Can I try to guess what that means about what they need for purple blocks to have done? Or in situations where multiple people have a condition referring to the same kind of component. So you have to try to reach a detente where both of you can get to the right place while you're still messing with the same blocks. Anyway, I see potential, but with two players, I thought it was not nearly substantial enough. No. Now, granted, it was only 10 to 15 minutes.
Yeah, so that's what I was about to come back at. That, yeah. You know, you can see that there's not much there, but it didn't as though we were tied into it for very long.
Yeah, when I initially heard the pitch, I erroneously thought that it sounded a little bit like Zendo, the Ice House classic where someone is trying to articulate a rule and other people are trying to guess it. But no, this was just a situation where all too often with the two-player setup, all our cards were perfectly compatible with each other. We just built something and we moved along. Tower Bricks.
They have four different levels of cards. You mix them up however you like. And like Mark said, there's different ways you can play. I would definitely recommend it. Check it out.
I got to play Walk the Plank Deluxe Edition. This is by Shane Steely and Jared Tinney, published by Mayday Games in 2017. This is the deluxe edition because it comes in a fancy tin, and it has screen-printed meeples. Ooh. There's also an expansion, which I'll get to later. Walk the Plank is a pirate-themed, kind of sort of take-that-ish, kind of sort of like Bang without the deduction game, because you have these action cards. Every round, you pick three action cards, and they're going to resolve in order. But by the time the cards get to execute, probably the game state is sufficiently different that your card will do something potentially unexpected or terrible. So, as an example, your goal is to keep your pirates away from the island because the island represents you being dead. You want to stay on the safety of the ship. So there's this plank between the ship and the island, and the plank can vary in length between 3 and 1 spaces. And you might say, oh, okay, at the top of the round, I don't have anybody on the plank. I can play the card that shortens the plank, bringing it down from 3 to 2, and everything will be fine. But by the time your card gets executed, all your pirates are on that third stage of the plank, and congratulations, they're all dead. Hijinks and wackiness. I didn't enjoy this at all. It was precisely of the kind of I'm forced to do a thing and just see what happens, whereby it only became slightly deterministic and interesting once the field had been whittled down, which meant that all the other players had been eliminated. And so once it's down to 2 or 3 players, you might start to be like, okay, well, if they play X and I play Y, then this other thing will happen. And you get a vaguely, vaguely Libertalia feel in the sense that you can kind of sort of guess through the chaos. But as it is, I mostly felt the chaos. And then the first player who gets eliminated, if you want, they can then play as the Ghost, which is the little mini expansion. And the Ghost can't win, but keeps playing. So it's just a spoiler. I was the first one who was eliminated. And I would say, oh, well, you can play as the Ghost. And the Ghost explained to me, I was almost disgusted at the structural idea of, yeah, you've lost, and you're going to keep playing just as a spoiler.
You get to play the participation ghost.
Yeah, something like that. And not only was I sufficiently displeased with how the game itself worked that I didn't want to play at all, I was also just, I didn't want to be a part of that particular expansion metric. The next person who was eliminated volunteered to be the ghost, but we just kept going anyway, so that's fine. Walk the Plank is not my kind of game, and I don't think it's executed very well. I was very happy for it to be over, such that I was actually happy that there was player elimination, even though normally I would think that that would be a detriment.
It's almost as though they should make it a race with mascots or something.
Very, very, very different kind of game. But yeah, that would make it better, sure. That's Walk the Plank, Deluxe Edition.
So the Spiel Awards were announced, and so I showed a bunch of people Bomb Busters. This is designed by Hayashi Hayashi, same designer as Yokohama, and it is put out by Piggish Spiel. And what you're trying to do is cut wires 1 through 12 until the person that has the red wires only has red wires left. And as their turn, they say, I only have red wires, and they reveal them. And you've won. Now, Mark, you've played a lot more Hanabi than I have.
Yes.
Would you compare this at all with Hanabi?
It is a little bit like Hanabi, only in the sense that it is a cooperative game with deduction elements.
Gotcha.
You know, the central conceit that really makes Hanabi sing is that you cannot see your cards. So the cards that you play, you have no idea what they are unless and until such time as players give you hints about them. So other people are trying to inform your play, as opposed to a more conventional setup, which is what Bombusters has, which is you know what all your wires are, and you're trying to find ways to communicate to the rest of your teammates about what they are through subtle inference and guessing what they have. Now, as it is, the way the numbers are set up I found interesting. So we were playing a three-player game, and so effectively there are these yellow wires which mess with the setup, and there are two of three possible variations. You set it up and said, okay, of these numbers, two of them are in play, and then the red numbers, which are super important, they can determine whether you win or lose. You said there are these two possible numbers that might be in play, and you laid them out. And then I saw that I had the 9.5, which is one of the red wires. And that gave me a whole bunch of information about what the play state was. So for one, I knew that nobody else had a red wire. I knew that the 7.5 wasn't in play. And I did enjoy using that in a way to communicate. Like, for example, the part that I felt vaguely pleased about was there was a moment where I had to guess what was in Chip the Third's hand. And basically, if I didn't know that the 7.5 wasn't in play, it would have been a grossly irresponsible risk. But I made it anyway, and I was hoping that that would give people enough information for them to know that I had the 9.5. But
yeah, no, I very much enjoyed it. It's right up my alley of that deduction. It's like, well, I have these three numbers, and that's what they have displayed, and there's three, you know, they have three chits left. Therefore, you know, this must be that, and that must be this, which means that is a seven. That kind of stuff I love.
I was a little unsettled by the frequency with which I had to make basically risky guesses. We played another cooperative deduction game, which we'll talk about in just a second. And there I feel like in a good cooperative deduction game, like Hanabi, for example, which we didn't play this week, I feel like when you have to make an educated guess, it's because you have other exogenous reasons for acting in a risky behavior, largely due to time constraints, or because there's been a set of mistakes that have taken place, often, again, somewhat relatedly, because of inefficiency. In Bomb Busters, I felt like during many turns, whether it was the beginning or the middle or the end game, where I look around and say, like, okay, I don't think I'm missing anything. I think I just have to take a risk.
Well, from the several games that I played, that one that we did play today was much different.
Oh, okay. It was a greater frequency, yes, of those risky guesses?
100%.
Okay. If there were a situation where it was more deduction and less wild gambit, I think I'd be much more positive on Bomb Busters. I thought it was okay. I'd much rather play Hanabi or Paint the Roses. Okay, spoiler alert. We also play Paint the Roses. We'll get to that in a second. But
so in Bomb Busters, like Legacy or Campaign-y, there's all these little tuck boxes that you get to open and you get to add stuff to the game. I'm sure there'll be, I have no idea what's in them. So I couldn't tell you. I know we opened the first one.
I'm guessing some of them have cards.
Some of them might have stickers. What those stickers do, I will not say.
Okay.
They're special, though.
The stickers is a rule stick.
They're pretty fancy.
Okay.
And that's Bomb Busters.
We also played Paint the Roses. Paint the Roses is also a cooperative deduction game. This is, I think, a brutally difficult game of cooperative deduction. I don't think I've ever won Paint the Roses. I don't claim to be especially good at cooperative deduction games, but I've definitely won games of Hanabi, and I've won more games of Bomb Busters than I've won of Paint the Roses. There you go. In Paint the Roses, every player has some sort of rule that the, let's be frank, murderously psychotic Queen of Hearts wants the garden to satisfy. It might be something very simple, like I want yellow flowers touching purple flowers. It's just color to color, or it might be slightly more complicated because instead of color to color, it might be shape to shape. I want diamonds to be touching clubs. Or it could be hard card, in which case, who knows, all bets are off. It could be anything touching anything. And so you place a tile, and then you just indicate how many times your rule has been satisfied. And then you have to guess as to what someone's rules are. Most of the time, what happens is my natural conservatism causes us to lose, in addition to my being generally thick, because I always want to gravitate towards the easy ones, but the dynamic of Paint the Roses is every turn the queen is advancing, and if the queen overtakes the gardener pawn, you lose. The only way you advance the gardener pawn is by getting these rules correct, with more difficult rules advancing you further. So if you satisfy easy rules all day long, you're still going to lose because the queen is going to overtake you because she moves too quickly. And I think that's one of the key problems. I think one of the issues, we were playing again with Chip the Third, and he started off by pulling a hard rule when nobody had taken an easy. And I just took it as axiomatically obvious that what you do is you open with one easy rule and everyone else takes mediums. And Chip the Third just shrugged and said in his inimical style, it's like, let's go hard. And it worked. It was shockingly successful. We made it to the last tile placement.
We did.
We had a 50-50 guess, and we guessed wrong. Now, again, sometimes in Paint the Roses, you make 50-50 guesses, but that's largely because time pressure. Or you made a mistake because you didn't place a tile to give maximum information to your partners, or your partners didn't draw the maximum universe of inferences from the decision you made. Like, well, no, you're sitting there vibrating with rage because they're failing to recognize that if you had had the other possibility on the 50-50 chance, you would have placed the tile elsewhere, giving them better information, and they haven't realized that.
Yeah, this is what I love about Paint the Roses. You look at your card, and it says pink to pink. And it is your turn. And so you're looking at this display of four tiles. And so you might be in trouble because there might not be any pink roses there. But let's just pretend there's a pink rose there. There might be even two. So now you have a choice because now you have to look at the board and match it up with another pink flower that's out there. And you think, well, that's easy. I'm sure there's one or two. But you have to look at the shapes as well because you're going to be putting cubes down and you're saying there's two matches. But now you might have matched clubs or you might have matched spades, so you gotta choose the right tile, put it in the right place, and also, like Merc just said, give information of why didn't he place it somewhere else,
or even take a different tile,
or even take a different tile.
Yeah,
love, like, everything about it.
So you place the tile, someone's like, well, it could be pink to pink, that's two matches, but it could also be spade to spade. It's like, look, if it were spade to spade, I would have taken the other tile and placed it there, gotten four matches, and made it unambiguous. Come on, people. But such is the nature of things. Yeah, Paint the Roses is extraordinarily well done. And it also has very satisfying big leg pieces.
Yep.
Honestly, I think it's second only to Hanabi of cooperative deduction games that I've played. I still prefer Hanabi. Hanabi's a classic. Antoine Bauza is a wonderful designer. And I really like how Hanabi works. And it also has a pleasant addition with big leg tiles. But Paint the Roses is extraordinarily well done.
Yeah, I wish we played it more. There's all sorts of modules in the box.
This is, and again, this I get into trouble with this all the time, Walker.
Modules.
I start teaching the game. It's like, okay, well, this is a module. You attach the module to your ship over here. And it's like, what is this guy talking about?
And so I'd really like to get into them. And because I think we tried one once and it seemed interesting. So.
But don't all of them make the game more difficult?
I'm not sure.
I think of the module, I haven't seen many of the modules. Many of the modules make the game more difficult. And given that I've never won the base game of Paint the Roses, that just seems a little too ambitious.
True.
But as I've just said, conservatism is one of my reliable character flaws.
Sorry, who publishes Paint the Roses again?
If only they had done the helpful indication of putting the name of the publisher on the back of each and every one of the game tiles so it's in your face the entire time. North Star Games, don't hide your light under a bushel. Walker's more bothered about this than I am. Walker has very strong opinions about card backs.
Yeah, it's worse card. I don't mind so much this because I had forgotten because you never even see the back of the tiles.
Yeah, because they're in a bag most of the time.
In the bag, and then you put them face.
Yeah, it's not that.
But cards, I hate it so much.
On the topic of card backs, I don't share Walker's frustration with putting the name of the game or the name of the publisher on the back of the cards, but I do have a high degree of appreciation when a publisher or a designer or what have you really puts a lot of effort in making the card backs look very, very nice. So the historical Pandemic variants, as a rule, tended to do this very nicely. Like Pandemic Iberia has this lovely mosaic work relating to Moorish Spain and all on all the card backs, lovely different designs. Fall of Rome does the same thing. It's a whole deal. I played Kinfire Delve Scorn's Stockade. So Kinfire Delve is a series of solo or cooperative card games, and there's a variety of different versions of them, and you can mix and match and use characters from one in the enemy deck of another. Anyway, Scorn's Stockade is the one I tried. These are all designed by Kevin Wilson, part of Incredible Dream Studios. Incredible Dream Studios has done a Gentle Rain, and there's a whole bunch of Kinfire stuff. There's also the Kinfire Chronicles cooperative board game, which I've kind of got half a mind to try. Anyway, Kevin Wilson, not entirely unlike Glenn Drover or even Martin Wallace, has had a bit of an interesting career arc in terms of now he's designing much more simple games, much more rules light compared to his old Fantasy Flight stuff. But Kinfire Delve has gorgeous card backs. In point of fact, all the character decks have a beautiful portrait of the character, as well as embossed foil details in terms of a lot of the elements. Every card is a foil card. It's really cool. It'd be cool even if the art weren't really well done, but it is really well done. I really appreciate that. And the design of the enemy card backs is also super cool. There's just a lot of really quality graphic design on the card backs and in general for Kinfire Delve that I appreciate. I don't think it's at its best solo. As a solo experience, I found it very mechanical and not particularly satisfying because at any given moment, you have four challenge cards that you can attempt. They could be enemies, they could be traps, they could be puzzles, whatever. But they just have a number that you have to get to. You're allowed to play a card from your hand. That card has to match the color of the thing you're attempting. And so your target number might be something like 9. And so I play my 2. And then you're allowed a couple of boosts, discard other cards to boost the value. Then you roll these dice that add a certain value, and you either get to the value or you don't. And there's a success condition if you meet the value, and a failure condition if you don't. And you just do this until you've gone through the entire enemy deck, and then you fight the boss. A lot of the abilities, a lot of the effects, a lot of even the damage conditions that apply to your hero are more interesting with multiple players. As a single character playing just one character, didn't really do much for me. It felt very, very dull in terms of hand management and just sort of, okay, well, what's in my hand? I don't have any greens. Okay, so I'm not attempting the green challenge. Okay, here's the red one. What's my best value for combat? Okay, here we go. Roll a die. Oh, I failed. I ticked down my life bar one. Okay, let's try it again. And just over and over and over again. And so even though I found a lot of it visually interesting, I didn't find the gameplay particularly compelling. With a partner, with somebody else playing, I think it would probably be more interesting in terms of the abilities. I'm not sure this is where I'd want to go, but this is at least an interesting counterpoint to another obvious comparison, which is to say One Deck Dungeon, which was designed primarily as a solo experience, and the multiplayer is kind of the variant version. Kinfire Delve, I get the opposite vibe. It seems to have been designed for two-player, and the solo version is just kind of, it feels more like an afterthought, especially in terms of how a lot of the abilities are done. I don't know, I might be inclined to try it two-player. It's a competitive space, and there are lots of things we want to get to, but if there was someone who wanted a very simple dungeon-y type of thing and you're going to be playing with two, then Kinfire Delve is probably okay. But as I say, solo player, I found it pretty repetitive and dull and mechanical in nature, even though I very, very much appreciate the cast and the artwork and the graphic design and a lot of the elements. So that is Kinfire Delve, specifically Scorn's Stockade.
So, Aboria from last year was pretty psychedelic in its color scheme. Enter Transgalactica, designed by Daniel Ticini and put out by Devier Games. This is a very colorful game, and it has tracks, lots of tracks. So, in Transgalactica, lots of tracks, and all the tracks have like an action space. And then when someone takes that action, everyone gets to go around the table and they decide whether or not they want to follow that action. And so you're going up political tracks, you're going up technology tracks, you're moving around this galaxy map and populating planets, making your mining track better, and you're improving your income. lots going on. This game has already like sort of a predetermined bad rule book. I'm not sure I'm going to have Mark talk about more of that when it's his turn.
It's pretty bad.
But it seems as though there might be something there, and I'm willing to give it a try. And believe it or not, there's one or two stickers that you have to apply first.
So almost every component is stickered. And I will say, I don't necessarily agree that the color scheme is particularly psychedelic. I just really think that there's a lot of visual inventiveness going on. Like, even really, really good space games, like, I don't know, like Quantum, for example. You know, you look at the different factions, and they all look like pretty standard sci-fi business. I'm not going to say that Transgalactica breaks any new ground, but Walker was playing the purple faction, and they look fabulous. They look like they know how to have a good time. And my faction, on the other hand, looked like a whole bunch of vaguely minion-inspired weird robot designs. And so there's a lot of visual interest to be had in terms of the stickering, although it's purely optional. Walker did...
Even the resources.
Yeah, even the resources get stickers. So it's you definitely get... This is not a small-ish Devere box game. This is not like Red Cathedral or like... The White Castle or what have you. It's a normal size box that they crammed to the gills with wood, all of which is to be stickered. It's wild.
Yeah, there's lots to do. I don't know what would you think of gameplay in general?
I was thinking of your comments not infrequently after certain medium or medium heavy Euros, which is the rhetorical question, what about this is fun?
Yeah, I was going to say that later. I was going to ask you the same thing.
And I didn't really feel any particular... This is a standard sort of kitchen sink Euro. You've got a whole bunch of tracks and mission cards to fulfill and text that you can unlock that don't really do anything particularly cool. And a military track that's entirely abstracted, that's just a precondition for something else and a whole bunch of whatever. And the core action selection struck me as relatively novel because it is very difficult... to do anything except by the primary action associated with that track. So if you want to increase military, there is one main action that's associated with that. So if somebody takes that, you can't go there for the rest of the game. Your only option is to follow. And you have to do it right then, and it's more expensive, and it's tricky. And so I really appreciated how consequential your action choices were, especially at the early parts of every round. And that does help to make the middle of the round flow pretty well. But ultimately, it felt kind of overlong and unfocused and mechanical and unsatisfying.
Yeah, unfocused to the maximum because there's so many like sort of tokens and symbols and everything everywhere. It's like I get a symbol here, and if I move up that track, that hits a symbol that's printed on the track, which lets me do something else, and I can use these symbols, you know, once per turn, and then income, I get to do other things. And yeah.
And it's odd that... Just as an indication of the kind of sprawl that you're indicating, one of the fundamental questions that a number of people had at the outset was, how do I get more workers? Which is not an unreasonable question because it's basically a worker placement game with some elaboration.
Yeah, and our whole top of our board is covered with our workers that we don't have access to.
Yeah, exactly. So how do we unlock workers? Like, well, it's this icon, which you can find over here and over there and over here and over there and over there. And then a few rounds in, because we had just not clocked it when setting up the game for the first time, someone built an outpost like, oh, you can unlock more workers by building outposts too. Yeah, we all look at our tribes like, oh, look at that. Who'd have thought? And so this isn't just a graphical representation issue because, again, most Euros have figured out that what you're supposed to do if you're going to be unlocking symbols by placing things – you print the icon next to the piece that covers it. So you don't have to look under the piece to figure out what it does. But by the same token, it's such a core element of your action economy. And it's just kind of scattered all over the place. It's like, well, how do I get more workers? Like, do stuff and things. Okay.
And how do you get points? Well,
yeah, it's you know, on top of that, it's a pretty traditional point salad thing.
Like, yeah.
I mean, I was reasonably pleased at Dewey's success at leveraging the military track in conjunction with a particular military technology that he'd unlocked. That was the closest it seemed to me, like, I have an idea about how to win, as opposed to, I'm just going to do a whole bunch of stuff, which is what Transgalactica seems to encourage you to do. Anyway, this doesn't exactly shock me, because Daniela Tashini's solo work has always been, for me, very, very hit or miss. I very much prefer Tashini's work that he's done with Luciani. I think those are... when they're designing games together. The only solo Tashini design that I think is kind of okay is Teotihuacan. And I have serious misgivings about Teotihuacan, just that how tracky it is. And it's a little more obtuse than it needs to be and a variety of other things. But if you thought that Teotihuacan is pretty satisfying, but you think it's trying to kind of pushing the envelope in terms of being a little unfocused and unscattered, stay away from Transgalactica, because it is absolutely the worst impulses at the heart of those designs without many of the redeeming features of something like Teotihuacan. So Transgalactica is very, very Tashini at his worst, I think.
Yeah, and if you don't want like constantly being on Board Game Geek to figure out the rule book and how things work,
yep.
You know, there's endless forums already a, you know, a new rule book, and it's a mess.
Yeah. Much of the time when I read a rule book and I see online that there's widespread complaints about the quality of the rule book, I'm like, yeah, I see what you're talking about, but it's okay. I figured it out. The Transgalactica rule book is pretty bad.
Yeah, it's too bad, because it seems as though, I'm not saying Yakata at its core was a good game, and same with Transgalactica. It seems to have its issues as well.
Yucatan.
It's a shame that those games are going to suffer because of...
Yeah.
Bad rule books.
In a market like this, if you don't have a solid rule set at launch, you're going to be in serious trouble. I'll give more of a pass to Transgalactica than to Yucatan, because Yucatan was in crowdfunding and it had a long development time. And there was time to cinch that up. And a lot of it was translation problems, which, quite frankly, you don't really have an excuse for that in a contemporary market.
And both were from major publishers. And it just doesn't make sense.
It's true.
Transgalactica.
Finally, we got to stream a play of Phantom Division on the birthday of Mark Thomas, one of the co-designers. This is a production sample we got from the publisher that is on loan for a while, where you have to send it back to them in time for Gen Con. And I have to say that in terms of leaning in to some of the really, really, really cool stealth and tempo dynamics of SEAL Team Flix, I think that Phantom Division has made all the right decisions. Now, that having been said, there are a couple of problems. One of them is every mission in Phantom Division, I love the way the mission victory conditions get set out. You set out some number, 1 to 3, of primary mission objectives. You know what those are, but you don't know where they are on the map. And then a whole bunch of hidden secondary objectives, which can, some of them are good, some of them are bad. Like you might reveal a guard, or you might reveal a med station or something. That's fine. That level of variation, I really don't mind. It's not a huge deal. What was a huge deal in the game we played was one of what's sort of twists that take place. They're called plot twists in the context of a mission of Phantom Division. And the first one we pulled was, and this is one of those things where it's like, this looks bad, we're tempted to bin it, but we're playing it just for the first few times, and so we'll let it play out, was it said you always get 2 guard roll spawns regardless of what the threat level is. The threat level is what's influenced by how much noise you're making, how often you're spotted, whether you've been attacked and so forth, and it really drives a lot of the stealth decision making. You really have to consider when to go loud, how to go loud, when to pick your spots, when to wait a couple turns to let the heat die down. When this plot twist is in play, all of that is gone. It doesn't matter how noisy you are. You could be entirely silent, you're going to get 2 guard spawns. You could be firing machine guns every turn all the time, you're going to get 2 guard spawns. I strongly disliked it. And I think that when we get our production copies, if that card is still in the deck, we're just going to get rid of it. We don't want to play that way.
Mine was mysteriously missing in my production copy.
You don't have a production copy, Walker. It hasn't been published yet. You're looking at me like you've just made a joke. I don't understand.
As in, yes, I'm also going to bin it.
Okay. Despite that, I do think that it had a negative effect on the game. But despite that, I had a great time.
Yeah.
You, Walker, why do you talk to us about how you and your shotgun became as one and fused to become a single destructive element?
I attuned with the moment.
Yeah.
It was the people watching. They gave me the power. The shots ricocheted down the hallways. People that didn't even know something was going on took a shotgun blast to the head. It was magical.
Walker was banking shotgun pellets off of 2 walls to hit a hidden security camera. He was shooting through doors. All this time, we're saying, by the way, Walker, just as a note, be very careful about this objective token, because it could be the hostage that we need to rescue. And he'd be like, don't worry. And then he'd start aiming for the guard that's standing right next to that objective token, and it was perfect. He didn't hit every shot, but the shots that he did hit were very impressive. It was great.
The other thing that makes these two games amazing, SEAL Team Flix and Phantom Division, are these mini games. So one of your your people go down, you get this mini game to revive. You're going to revive anyway with one hit point, but you could play this mini game, and if you do well, you're going to get more hit points, or you're going to unlock a door, or you're going to defuse a bomb. It's all these different cards that you set up in different ways, either to knock discs off it or to manipulate this marble around. All of them great, and keeps the game, you know, very interesting and fun.
Yeah. We haven't really received responses to our set of rulebook concerns. They say they're working on it. They say they're doing a pass on the cards and a whole bunch of things. Anyway, I'm cautiously optimistic that they'll make the right decisions. But as it is, it's worth emphasizing once again, when playing a co-op game, I'm more than happy. I mean, even a game like Transgalactical I am, but especially in a co-op game, if there's an area of ambiguity, I'm more than happy to just pick something and keep going. Because, you know, it's a co-op game. The balance doesn't have to be perfect. You can just decide and go on in case of rules ambiguity. In the context of Phantom Division, the overwhelming majority of the time, if the rules are ambiguous, we can shrug and do it the way it works in SEAL Team Flicks. Because we've been playing SEAL Team Flicks for years, and we've got a pretty good grasp on how that game works. And so if the Phantom Division rulebook is silent on an issue, we can just do it the same way that it works in SEAL Team Flicks. Like, for example, one of the issues that just isn't covered in the rulebook is if you fire a shot and that shot doesn't destroy crates, but it moves crates around as a result of you flicking discs, what happens to the crate? And we assumed that because that's the way it works in SEAL Team Flicks, you put it back to where it started. You reset everything that shouldn't have been affected by the shot back to where it was at the beginning. And in this context, Mark Thomas, who was on the chat, confirmed that for us. I'm very concerned, though, very much like it happened when people got SEAL Team Flicks into their hands for the first time. People who don't have any experience with this rule system, whether they'll be able to make the same accommodations that we can, given our past history. So I really, really hope they tighten those things up. But that plot twist notwithstanding and some rules queries notwithstanding, I think that Phantom Division is a solid improvement on SEAL Team Flicks, which is already one of our favorite hobbyist things of the past 10 years. It's glorious. The minigames are glorious. The stealth dynamics are glorious. It's a fabulous game.
And they just wrap up the AI, the, you know, in between turns when the enemies move, quick, fast, easy, doesn't, no downtime, and you're on to your own turns again. Anyway, yep. It's fantastic.
So those are the games we played last week, and now a quick break to pay some bills.
This episode is brought to you by ExpressVPN. I know people who spend over $100 on streaming services every month, but with ExpressVPN, you can cut back to just Netflix and get a massive amount of content. Netflix hides stuff from you based on your location, but ExpressVPN can let you access content region-locked in over 100 different countries. For example, The Shawshank Redemption is available in neither the US nor Canada, but with ExpressVPN, you can say bonjour or konnichiwa to the servers that carry it. My American friends can pretend to be Canadian and enjoy Downton Abbey, which they normally can't on account of some revolution or something. I've tried other VPNs, and ExpressVPN is my favorite. It's incredibly easy to use, lightweight, super fast, and it works on all my devices. I have way too many. With just the click of a button, I can swap back and forth to or from any region's content. So be smart. Stop paying full price for streaming services and only getting access to a fraction of their content. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/sowronggames. Don't forget to use my link at expressvpn.com/sowronggames to get an extra 4 months of ExpressVPN for free.
And we're back. Now onto the news and why it doesn't matter. SwagCon. Looking forward to seeing you. This weekend.
All your listeners. It's going to be great.
Well, not all the listeners. We have substantially more listeners.
Well, the ones that matter.
Oof. I would just like to note that Walker's comments do not reflect the editorial policy of So Very Wrong About Games, its hosts, or the Gibbons that run it.
Yeah, I feel sorry for the people that cannot make it. It's going to be a good time. A weekend of gaming here in Kingston. And
it's
going to
be fun times, good vibes only.
It's true.
Now onto our topic, Walker.
Take that, Mark.
I'd rather not. I'd really, you know what? I don't want to take that, and I don't want to be the one telling people to take that.
And I think it means a different thing to everyone.
I agree.
I think if you like ask someone to define it, what take that means, I think you're going to get a plethora of different answers.
I have an attempt at the sort of definition that, as it applies to our group and what we don't like.
All right.
That is, take that is the ability to inflict harm to any player at little to no cost or risk, typically, though not necessarily, via a card play.
Yeah, mine's a little different.
Sock it to me.
I think I don't have it written, like, it's mostly just
vibes.
Do I have it?
What vibes does my sketch of a definition not account for?
Well, it's mostly just random for me. If it's just, if you've drawn a card or a tile flips up and it's just a completely random thing, it's more like, you know, when you're playing cooperative games and the event cards come up, it's like a take that from the game. When that kind of mechanism comes out and hits players, I hate it. I hate when a particular card or action destroys past turns. Like, I've taken turns to get this resource in order to, and then I have to take another action to turn that resource into this resource, which let me buy this item. And there was four items. And now I'm going to play this card, my fourth action, to use that item. And then someone plays a card. No, that item's destroyed now. So my four turns that I've just taken to build this thing, wasted. Wasted sure. turns. I cannot tell you how angry it makes me.
Well, that's getting closer to my definition, though, that active intervention by the player. When playing a co-op, I guess I could accept your definition of a take that inflicted by the system. But in the case of a co-op, you're all in it together. And so
it's definitely not a take that in a cooperative thing. It's totally different.
I accept your analogy. I think it is kind of like the game system issuing a take that. But in those contexts, I don't think it generates the same sense of feeling, again, because we're all in this together.
Yeah,
and any resources you have are by extension resources that the group has.
Yeah, it's shared. Yeah, if one of your teammates is hurt, then the whole team is hurt, right?
Yeah.
So it's a shared thing, yeah.
Yeah, that notion, if... I think there's a fundamental element, though. It's the arbitrariness of the targeting that I really hate. Because if I'm going to do something and I am stopped and I am able to understand why the player did that to me, it makes perfect sense. Like, we've been locked in a battle. Like, if I start a fight with somebody and they start playing cards and they're chopping off my knees and they're completely reversing the tides of battle. You gave an example of Dune Imperium Uprising.
Yes.
Right? And you got into a fight and the cards that came that hit the table during that fight were stronger than you would have liked. I'm not saying that that's an inappropriate preference. I completely understand where you're coming from, and I might even agree with you. That, to me, isn't take that. That's just, you know, arbitrariness from a card deck, whatever. But if you didn't have any choice in starting the fight, and suddenly people are playing cards, and it's not just that they're winning the fight, but they're also taking away the points that you scored last turn, or the worker that you get to place next turn, or whatever, that, to me, is take that. And I agree with you. The wasted turns of it all, the fact that you were planning for something and now you can't because of this weird exogenous thing that happened for no reason, it feels like you just got to have all your work taken out from you, and it's terrible. I hate that feeling too.
Yeah, it's like skip a turn.
Yeah. We hate it so much that this sensation happened to me very recently, actually, when we were playing The Breach. Right, we still don't really know what we feel about The Breach. We haven't played a game to completion. Everybody has their own deck of, they're called malware cards because you're all hackers. And a bunch of them come from the character you've chosen. They also come from a support character that you pick. And so often you read a rule book. It's like, okay, you have a bunch of action cards and they explain how and why they're played. Okay, fine. But then sometimes when you actually get the cards in your hand, I suddenly start worrying, oh, wait, are any of these take that cards? Crap. Wait, oh, no. And it's this dread that I feel. And fortunately, so far in The Breach, I haven't seen any of those. Again, there are cards that impede other players, but it's all because you started a fight with them or they started a fight with you and you defend yourself or whatever. That's fine.
It's so hard in a game like The Breach, right? That's like a PvP where you're supposed to be going around and attacking everybody anyway to like sort of define what a take that card is in that particular scenario.
Yeah, a lot of it is vibes-based, though. And again, the arbitrariness of targeting is something. Like, so again, to talk another game that's not really take that in my estimation, well, for the most part, is Black Rose Wars, because there are range considerations, there are card considerations, and so forth, and you understand why people are doing what they're doing, because another big difference between doing damage to somebody in Black Rose Wars and your example of stealing, of like, oh, you don't have that resource anymore, it's destroyed. If I'm damaging you in Black Rose Wars, it's because I want to score when you're dead. And when you're dead, you just show up and keep playing. Who cares? As opposed to, oh, that wood's destroyed. Did you do that to get the wood? That at least makes, you know, if you're stealing resources, I'm not going to defend that, but it makes it better than just the resource going away, because then it just feels so incredibly arbitrary and pointless.
Yeah, there's a bunch of that in Terraforming Mars, where you just you have cards where it says, you know, whoever has the most plants, destroy the plants.
The perfunctory player interaction in a Euro tableau builder that has take that elements, it's so painful. It's one of the things that, I mean, everybody... I don't know that anybody, even the people who really, really like Terraforming Mars, are like, yeah, those elements are great. It's so strange.
And then there's, and I can see where some people like that type of thing, right? Because they did it in Ark Nova, where they have the, I think it's called Venom or something. I don't play a lot of Ark Novas. I can't tell. But there's a mechanism on some of the cards, and you just choose not to play with that particular mechanism, or you can. And so there's, you can just add a take that mechanism to the game.
Yeah. I think part of that is because Ark Nova was so clearly, I was about to say aping, but then there's an ape joke in there somewhere. So clearly emulating elements of Terraforming Mars, I don't know. It's just, it is so hard, I would say borderline impossible, to do take that or theft or destruction cards like that well in a Euro. I remember there's one, this is one of the worst Euros that I remember playing, so painful, so overlong, a game called Yedo. And it was the classic example of, you read the rules, and it just says, look, there are these decks, here's how you get the cards, here's how you play the cards. And then you start playing, and then about some number of minutes into the game, you see that player look at the card, scrunch up their face in that scowl that says, I'm not going to like playing this, and you're not going to like it after I play it. And that's just the telltale example of, this is going to be a take that card game in a Euro management game. Doesn't turn out well.
That's what I mean. It turns out like the game you were just talking about today, that the pirate, cutthroat pirate, what is it called?
Walk the plank.
Where you just have no control, right? And it's all started with games like Munchkin and Cutthroat Caverns, right? Where
Bang is another good example.
Or Bang. Like, what is the point of me strategizing anything?
Yeah.
When the game state's going to change so much and so much chaos is going on, and there's just so much take that, what is the point? Just hop on the Red Dragon Inn bandwagon and just ride the good time.
Yeah.
But it's just, sometimes it's just not a good time for some people. That's just not the kind of game experience that they want.
Well, and so frequently, it's telling that you mentioned Munchkin. That reminds me of another game that basically all you have are take that cards, which is Kill Dr. Lucky. Those games tend to end not because of good play, but because of exhaustion. Just nobody has the right card when you're about to win to knock you down a peg. And it's just not, like, look, in Munchkin, one of the defenses could be, it's like, oh, well, you know, there is conscious targeting. You're not just targeting someone arbitrarily. You're targeting them because they're in the lead or they're about to win. It's like, sure. Then the person who wins is just the one who gets lucky when they're on the cusp and nobody has the right cards left anymore, because the first person who is about to win, who's probably playing better, all things being equal, he wasted all their cards on them. So congratulations, the third place player wins instead. There are some exceptions, though. I'm very eager to talk about those. I sense you have more complaints to levy first.
No, I'm just talking about, complaints. I'm just trying to define, get the definition down, because when it's known information, like when it's like getting tiles that are shown before other players, or getting to action spots when you know it's, you know, like in I had, like, Gaia Project is just sort of the antithesis of this, right? It's like getting to those planets before other people do, getting to those actions places before other people do. It's all known. There's no sort of, it's not sort of take that. It's like,
well, Gaia Project also doesn't really have any way to harm anyone.
No. But I mean, taking those away from, like, getting there before other people is, in a way, harming them, right?
Yeah, but I mean, if you look at the games that we like that involve a lot of direct confrontation, you know, Senji and Kemet are the two of the troops on a map games where you're constantly fighting, and those fights do harm the individual. But there are two things to keep in mind. One, there tend to be compensatory elements to having your teeth kicked in, not, you know, so you're not completely knocked out of the game. There's not a whole lot of sense of infrastructure that you are losing by virtue of losing a fight. And also, you can see, broadly speaking, the contours of the fight developing. You see battle lines developing. You know when there's a valuable target that you're leaving poorly defended. You have time to prepare for the fight. And if you end up on the back foot, it's your fault. And, you know, by your fault, maybe it's okay because you don't care. You're willing to take that loss because you're building towards somewhere else to go do your own thing. And so there are ways to have games with direct conflict, with harm inflicted on other players, that don't have that frustration element of take that.
That's right.
So some examples that I like to point to, I think personally the designer in the current space who is doing more interesting things with games that are even very structurally similar to Take That games is Jenna Feli. So Dur the Lesser Houses and Murray the A-Hole Frog, right? Some of it is subtle. Murray the A-Hole Frog is, I guess, Murray isn't really subtle. He's a bit of an a-hole that way. But it's just, sometimes it's the framing. The way Murray the A-Hole Frog works is, you know, you're building these sets of bugs to score points, and sometimes Murray shows up and just destroys them. And the thing is, though, it's bizarre. It's a take that element. When you pull Murray, you have to decide who's getting hit. But there are two things that kind of blunt that. One of them is Murray is just instantly executed whenever Murray gets drawn off the top of the deck. So it's like, well, I got to do it. And number two, you blame Murray.
That's right.
If Walker pulls Murray, and even if he targets me arbitrarily, like he quote-unquote should have nuked somebody else's set and he nukes mine, like, oh, Walker can... And inevitably says that Murray's going to be that way. We all know Murray's an a-hole. And you know what? It works. It's shocking, but it works. Duer of the Lesser Houses is similar in that all the time you're just playing effectively everything you do in Duer of the Lesser Houses is a take that card. It's like rumor on your face, scandal on your face, rumor on your face. And first of all, the fact that that's all you're doing kind of blunts some of the bad feelings. But also it's the case that the diplomatic element, the very, very light, somewhat constrained element of negotiation really helps to focus and contextualize why things are happening the way they're happening. And so, like, structurally, the way that Duer of the Lesser Houses and Murray the A-Hole Frog work shouldn't be in accordance with my settled preferences, especially with respect to take that. I have yet to leave a game of Duer or Murray the A-Hole Frog with bad feelings. And that, I think, is a minor triumph, given the sort of structure that they are. And there's a whole bunch of clever things that Genifelli does, either deliberately or accidentally, to really make those take that games work.
And it's obvious that we don't like it, because I was going through sort of our library and all the games that we play, trying to figure, you know, which games have any sort of take that elements to them. And we don't have very many at all.
It's true. It's true. They're very rare. I would also like to point out another game that has take that elements in it and that mostly works despite it. And that, well, I think it does. And that's Cosmic Encounter, which is very divisive. But once again, I just want to plug the Destiny deck in Cosmic Encounter because it is so good at removing the whining and the sense of arbitrariness in so many other games. When it is your turn in Cosmic Encounter, you go attack somebody, but the deck tells you who to attack. Everybody has three instances, or, well, it varies by player number and expansion, but whatever. There's a certain number of instances that you're going to get attacked over the course of the game, of course, they go through the deck. Walker comes and attacks me, not because he's picking on me, but because the deck told him to. And that is a great way to blunt that sense of bad feeling that take that games have. And then, once the fight starts, yeah, there might be a whole bunch of flares and artifacts that hit the table, but the fight was started not by anyone's control. And once we're in the fight, it's perfectly reasonable for Walker to play that one shot against me. But he wasn't the one that pulled the trigger. The deck told him to. And so it doesn't always, like, I've walked away from games of Cosmic Encounter with bad feelings. Absolutely, it happens. There's so much chaos and so much, you know, take that elements or take that adjacent elements. But the Destiny deck serves to blunt and mitigate so much of that. I think it's a work of genius. I'm surprised that more games don't use it.
I'm thinking, well, I wonder if that's the thing, because I do have an example here. I'm wondering if you have that one resource that everyone needs and therefore all bets are off, right, in order to get that resource. I'm thinking like Barrage, right? There is, I feel, you know, I think it walks that line of what is take that and what isn't, right? I put this dam and now you're not getting any of this water, but everybody needs that water. You know right off the beginning there's going to be a fight for that water, and so it is a little take that-y in a way, right? Or is it just really hyper-competitive? I'm just not sure. That tight line, right?
I think it's a good example. I don't know that I'd call it take that, in part because the decision to build in Barrage is so transparent. It's difficult to do. It doesn't come out of nowhere. And it doesn't affect the water that's there now. So it's not like there's a whole lot of water stealing right now. It just means that dam you built, or that what other insulation you built, you have to make sure that it's useful at least in the short term. Whether it's going to be as useful medium to long term is a function of other people's decisions, absolutely. But furthermore, those decisions are not going to be arbitrary and they're going to be expensive. So those are two things that I think distance it from take that. So I would say it's just a very, very hyper-competitive Euro over scarce resources. It's one of the reasons why we like it, frankly.
Yeah. I just thought it was an interesting example. Like,
it is.
Is it? Is it not? And there might be other games like that where it's that one resource that everyone's going for.
Yeah, it's a little bit like another similarly competitive Euro in the sense of Food Chain Magnate. Like, there's a finite amount of food to be sold, and everyone's going to be fighting over those sales.
Yeah, I did have that up as, I know, like, it's so brutal.
It is. But again, it's not an arbitrary, simplistic thing. It's like, it's just a hyper competitive environment where there's a finite amount of resources and you need to make sure that you can protect your interests.
Yeah, it's that advertising. Someone puts an advertising down and it completely changes the whole landscape.
Or they undercut your price by one or they change the supply. I shouldn't say that there's a finite amount of demand. The market is effectively infinite in food chain magnate, if you think about it hard enough. But it is the case that there's a finite amount of sales to be sold every turn, and you desperately need to worry about that.
Yeah, we need to play food chain magnate. So good.
Is there an upcoming event where we could play Food Chain Magnate?
There is. It's a convention coming up, I think.
You don't say.
Yeah.
So that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. Thank you so much for taking the time. You can find all our information online at sowronggames.com and at patreon.com/svag. We hope to see you again soon. Take care, everybody.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bickman. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.